People in Iran, Iraq, and other countries mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror commanders. U.S. Democrats and a group of Republicans blast as undemocratic an attempt by nearly a dozen senators to challenge Joe Biden's presidential victory in Congress. The United States has reported a record of more than 277,000 daily COVID-19 infections, raising the total confirmed cases to 20.4 million. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Now, people in Iraq have marked the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. People in the Iraqi capital Baghdad held a candle vigil near the city's airport. The ceremony took place at the site of a drone attack that took the lives of General Soleimani al-Mohandes last January. Earlier on Saturday, Iraqi people also hit the streets of Baghdad to mourn the deaths of the two commanders. They chanted slogans demanding revenge for their killings. Iraqi demonstrators also renewed calls for the expulsion of American forces from their country. Anti-American sentiments have been growing in Iraq since the U.S. killing of Soleimani and al-Mohandes. From the Yemeni city of Sada, in the same story as I was just telling you about, the Iraqis commemorating the assassination of General Soleimani and the Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. Different events have been taking place in different parts of the world. It was not only in Iraq and Iran we had yesterday and the day before.
أمثال الشهيد المجاهد اللواء الركن أمين حميد الحميري ونحن من هذا المكان
People in Yemen out there in the streets, large crowds of people from the Yemeni city of Sada, special ceremony attended by masses of people. They are commemorating the first anniversary of the assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Soleimani. Well, as far as I understand, the speaker in Arabic is reciting sentences and people are repeating after him, and they're pledging allegiance with the path of resistance spreading out in the region, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Syria, also in Yemen. And they are commemorating the icons of resistance in the region. That is General Soleimani of Iran and also Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, the commander of the PMU forces, the deputy commander in Iraq. And this is the resistance, the front in Yemen against the Saudi aggression, that the people there are now, apart from paying homage to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, they're also renewing their allegiance with the path of resistance in the region, including in Yemen. This is putting up stiff resistance against the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Now, Tehran University professor Elham Kadkhodai says that the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani has strengthened his legacy in Iran and elsewhere in the region.
The killing of General Soleimani was an act of terror. So that's that. The second fact is that, you know, Iran has been experiencing these types of terrorism from the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution. You know, some very, very important, significant figures in Iran, like Ayatollah Beheshti, were assassinated with the hope of stopping this kind of march that the Iranian people had started towards their own independence. So the whole thing, you know, you have a system in Iran. Iran has got a sophisticated military, political system that's not going to be stopped with a few acts like this, killing individuals. Of course, General Soleimani was a very significant figure. He had a lot of influence in the way that the Quds Force was acting, but certainly nothing is going to be stopped without him. Everything is just going to go on as, the way it was going before, even maybe stronger, because this act of terrorism has angered the Iranian people. The funeral itself was something that attracted a lot of attention. I mean, it was something that the whole machinery of Western propaganda could not deny. So people were seeing Iranians flocking to the streets to say their last goodbyes, their last farewell to the beloved general. But I still believe that the true personality, the true character of General Soleimani is not somehow known in the West.
Iranian academics have marked the first anniversary of the assassination of top commander Soleimani. They also called for studies to be made on the personality of the general who served as a role model for the youth. Salman Kujuri has a report on that.
Tehran University has held a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Minister of Science and Technology, who was attending the ceremony, said that universities and academic centers have great capacities to keep the path of Qasem Soleimani alive by studying different aspects of his personality and beliefs.
General Qasem Soleimani was a great person. His personality had different aspects. I believe that academic centers should study his behaviors and personality. I think his lifestyle and beliefs serve as a good role model for all the youth of our country and the world. We have great capacities and potentials at universities and academic centers in this regard.
The event in Tehran came as people and officials attended a ceremony in the city of Kerman, the burial place of General Qasem Soleimani, to remember his lofty status 1 year after his martyrdom.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani had a big impact on the minds of people, both because of his own personality and what happened after his martyrdom. Therefore, for a researcher and expert of social sciences, his martyrdom provides a wide range of topics to study.
General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, and his trench mate Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated along with their companions in a U.S. terror drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Meanwhile, in response, the IRGC targeted the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad in Anbar province in western Iraq to retaliate the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Moreover, according to Iranian officials, Tehran has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for assassinating General Soleimani, and soon a court session will be held in Iran in this regard. Iranian officials believe that more than anything, the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has proved to the global public opinion that the U.S. administration is the leading sponsor of terrorism in the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Also in Syria, people have come together in the capital, Damascus's countryside, to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq. Press TV's correspondent, Mohammed Ali, has more in his report.
Crowds of people as well as officials have flocked to Sayyida Zainab Shrine near Damascus to pay tribute to Iranian top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. In an address to the ceremony, Iran's ambassador to Syria said General Soleimani was a symbol assassinated by the U.S. to force Iranians to kneel, stressing that the resistance front will triumph and take revenge of Soleimani's blood.
The Iranian nation will never sit back against those who carried out the crime. Those behind the crime will be punished. Iran will continue supporting Syria and its army until the Syrian army's sovereignty is restored on all territories.
Other speakers underlined the effective role of martyr Soleimani in defeating Daesh terrorists in Syria and Iraq, and foiling Western plots across the region. representative of the Syrian army in the ceremony, praised General Soleimani as a brave and wise commander who won the trust of all resistance fighters.
We have gathered here today tribute to Martyr Soleimani. His sacrifices will not be forgotten. We will continue adhering to resistance as a sole option. We promise Martyr Soleimani that his memory will be our path.
The crime of assassinating General Soleimani amounts to international terrorism in its ugliest form. General Soleimani's assassination is a great loss to Iran, Syria, and the resistance front. But thousands of Soleimanis are yet to come.
Photos of General Soleimani were also showcased in and around Sayyida Zainab Shrine. General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in January 2020 in Iraq, led Iranian military advisors in Syria for years across Syrian territories, mainly Aleppo, Damascus, and Deir ez-Zor. His command played a major role in restoring stability to hundreds of square kilometers in Syria. General Soleimani's significant achievements in Syria cannot be forgotten by the people here. Syrians have marked his first martyrdom anniversary by showing appreciation to his support and acknowledgement that security in so many areas in Syria wouldn't have been possible without his presence. Hamad Ali from Sayyida Zainab Shrine, Damascus Countryside.
The 3rd of January marks the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's General Soleimani. While people are mourning his death, many are reflecting on his significance, such as how he eradicated terrorism and supported the Palestinian cause. Many have also seen the true nature of the U.S. after it assassinated a man who was key in defeating the Daesh terrorist group.
On the morning of January the 3rd, 2020, the world woke up to the news that top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani had been martyred in Baghdad by a US drone strike, killing General Soleimani and his entourage. The assassination came as Lieutenant General Soleimani had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government as part of his ongoing mission to fight terrorism in the region, terrorism that saw the Daesh group firmly in the sights of the Iranian military hero. The killing of General Soleimani was unlawful, as UN rapporteur Agnes Callamard clearly pointed out in her report following the assassination, suggesting a legal case against the perpetrators was the way forward. With the ultimate decision to perform the strike on the convoy of General Soleimani lying solely at the feet of the US president, it seems that Iran has a clear case against Trump for the charge of a war crime, as there was no justification for the killing, as confirmed in the UN report. However, the fact that the assassination took place and very little has been done on an international scale to condemn the murder, it appears to have given a green light to other nations to take illegal actions against Iran, in particular the recent example of the killing of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, with officials stating that there had been strong indications that the Israeli regime had been involved in the attack.
Yes, certainly there has to be accountability for this violent and illegal assassination of General Soleimani. The United States, of course, has always felt it is above the law. It doesn't have to maintain any kind of respect for international law or human rights. And that is one of the reasons that the Donald Trump administration proceeded with this assassination. However, this sends the wrong message to the world community. If the United States can get away with it, then anyone can get away with it. So this must be pursued in the international courts. It's interesting to see that Iran is doing just that.
Yet as the anniversary approaches and ultimately passes, Iran has clearly stated that it will pursue its legal duty to fight for justice for the assassination of General Soleimani, and the memory of the talented and much respected general will live on forever in the hearts of those seeking to continue his mission of making the region a safer place to live.
Now, the targeted killing of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is deemed illegal based on international law. Iran has opened a war crime case against the U.S. and President Donald Trump. Tehran says it will pursue the case at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Now, the U.S. has said that it killed General Soleimani because he had posed an imminent threat, but Washington has failed to provide evidence for the claim. Now, President Trump himself has stated that he ordered Soleimani's assassination. Therefore, he should be prosecuted for the illegal act. Now, it's a matter of time that Trump would be prosecuted or not, but if there is no accountability, other nations could view the inaction as a green light to assassinate key officials of other countries.
The humiliating defeat for Donald Trump that saw Joe Biden sweep to a landslide victory is a sign of just how poor the decisions made have been perceived by the people of the US. Yet as the commander-in-chief of the US military, his decision to call the strike on General Soleimani was a decision that severely dented his international reputation. But as his last few days in office approach, US boats in the Persian Gulf have started maneuvers in the region, suggesting that Trump is looking for one last act of power prior to his departure, believing that until now, he's gotten away with his heinous acts. But for Iran, the most wicked act of all has yet to be dealt with. The assassination of General Soleimani has yet to see Iran take revenge for the murder, and is something that Iran has stated cannot be rushed and will happen in a matter of time.
I think we can say that currently Iran is taking action against the United States by pursuing this assassination in the courts. Someone must be held responsible and accountable for the assassination. Iran is going through the proper channels to do so. That is certainly one method that Iran can take to rectify this situation. The United States, on the other hand, if it's going to invade Iran, it's going to happen in the next 19 days, which is the last of Donald Trump's administration. While I don't expect things will improve greatly under a Biden administration, they will certainly improve somewhat, probably to the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
But for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the hero of people from across the region and the rest of the world, his ongoing work is being continued by devoted followers and freedom fighters from Iraq to Syria and Palestine to Yemen, and this continuation will be one of the best forms of revenge. Furthermore, with General Soleimani being a champion of fighting terrorism in the region, as well as resisting the US presence in the area, it seems that the sweetest revenge of all has been the victory over the US-backed Daesh group and the American assets in the region leaving the area, providing a safe, free, and healthy living environment for the people of the region.
Now, in other news, a group of U.S. Republican senators has pledged to reject Joe Biden's victory during a congressional meeting to certify the results of the presidential election. Senator Ted Cruz is spearheading the challenge. Joined by his 10 other colleagues, Cruz says that they want Congress to investigate claims of vote rigging during the November 3rd election in 10 days. The largely symbolic move is unlikely to succeed, as most senators are expected to confirm Biden as president on the 6th of January. That's when Congress counts the Electoral College votes. Democrats and moderate Republicans have blasted the effort as undemocratic. The Biden campaign has also dismissed it as theater. President Donald Trump has refused to concede defeat and repeats unproven claims of election fraud. The United States has reported a record of more than 277,000 daily COVID-19 infections, raising the total confirmed cases to 20.4 million. With just under 350,000 deaths, more people have died of the virus in the U.S. than anywhere in the world. Experts are warning that another 115,000 could die over the next month. Hospitalizations are also at their highest level, with a record number of patients being admitted into hospitals for the fourth straight day. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it's administered more than 4 million first doses of COVID-19 vaccines in the country out of over 13 million distributed doses. The figure falls well behind President Trump's promise of 20 million jabs by the end of 2020. India has given the green light for the emergency use of two COVID-19 vaccines. The one approved vaccine has jointly been developed by AstraZeneca and Oxford University, while another one by Indian pharmaceutical firm Bharat Biotech. India's drug regulator says the shots of COVID-19 have been authorized for restricted use. The approval is expected to kick off one of the world's biggest vaccination drives. India has a population of 1.3 billion. It's the world's second most infected nation, with more than 10 million COVID cases and 150,000 deaths. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. COVID-19 inflicted substantial economic damage on some Latin American countries. Aside from the initial health shock, economies were hit by declining commodity prices, a huge drop in export volumes, loss of remittances and tourism revenue, and unprecedented capital outflows early in the crisis. As a result, many large and small firms ran out of cash and had to close down. China's quick economic recovery has since boosted commodity prices, and remittances have picked up too. But the picture for capital flows remains mixed. With Latin America managed to avoid a lasting panic, private outflows often offset the inflows from issuing government bonds abroad. Mexico likely ran a current account surplus in 2020, with South America as a whole being close to balance, suggesting that external financing conditions remain tight. This current account performance also indicates that Latin American governments' counter-cyclical fiscal spending was insufficient to offset the drop in private consumption and investment. Whereas governments in advanced economies deployed a broad array of discretionary fiscal measures amounting to 20% of gross domestic product GDP, the International Monetary Fund puts the corresponding figure in Latin America at 7%. Only four countries, Peru, Brazil, Chile, and Bolivia, had packages totaling 10% or more of their gross domestic product GDP, and this figure includes loans and deferred taxes, in addition to extra public expenditure. We now present you an article written jointly by Mauricio Cardenas, Eduardo Levy Yeyati, and Andres Velasco. The piece is titled Latin America's Pandemic of Mounting Troubles. The article has been published on LiveMint.com website. Many regions perform badly when confronted with COVID-19, but Latin America fared worse than most in terms of both lives and livelihoods lost. As of November 2020, 9 of the 20 countries with the highest number of COVID-19 deaths per capita were in Latin America. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, expected the region's output to drop by 8.1% in 2020, with only the Eurozone suffering a bigger regional decline. As a result, almost 15 million more Latin Americans will live in extreme poverty. The first explanation for the region's underperformance that comes to mind is poor leadership. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro initially claimed that the pandemic was a media trick. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador denied for weeks that the coronavirus was a threat and continued to hug and handshake with supporters, only to reverse course suddenly and impose a strict lockdown. But even in those countries that acted early, containment measures were ineffective at reducing the number of COVID-19 cases. In Argentina and Peru, which locked down hard, and Chile and Colombia, which followed a more flexible approach, ultimately suffered similar dismal health outcomes. That was partly because some Latin American countries' starting point was far from ideal. Too many people had pre-existing health problems, and the prevalence of multi-generational living arrangements facilitated contagion and infection of those most at risk. Large informal labor markets made lockdowns hard to enforce. A high incidence of face-to-face jobs, including in retail sales, and a scarcity of remote work opportunities owing to poor connectivity and low digital literacy didn't help either. Government ineffectiveness left healthcare systems unprepared, despite early lockdowns that postponed the contagion peak. None of this excuses the fact that many policymakers did too little too late, but it helps to explain why different strategies yielded similar outcomes. The performance of Uruguay, the region's sole success story, arguably shows what a combination of universal healthcare access, greater labor market formality and social protection, relatively strong state capacity, and sensible leadership might have delivered for all of Latin America. COVID-19 inflicted substantial economic damage on Latin America, not least because the region suffered five synchronous blows. Aside from the initial health shock, economies were hit by declining commodity prices, a huge drop in export volumes, loss of remittances and loss of tourism revenue, and unprecedented capital outflows early on in the crisis. As a result, many large and small firms ran out of cash and had to close down. China's quick economic recovery has since boosted commodity prices, and remittances have picked up too. But the picture for capital flows remains mixed. While Latin America managed to avoid a lasting panic, private outflows often offset the inflows from issuing government bonds abroad. Mexico likely ran a current account surplus in 2020, with South America as a whole being close to balance, suggesting that external financing conditions remain tight. This current account performance also indicates that Latin American governments' counter-cyclical fiscal spending was insufficient to offset the drop in private consumption and private investment. Whereas governments in advanced economies deployed a broad array of discretionary fiscal measures amounting to 20% of the gross domestic product GDP, the International Monetary Fund puts the corresponding figure in Latin America at 7%. Only four countries in Latin America, Peru, Brazil, Chile, and Bolivia, had packages totaling 10% or more of their GDP. And this figure includes loans and deferred taxes, in addition to extra public expenditure. Some countries, like Mexico, could have spent more but chose not to, while many others lacked fiscal space or were unable to tap capital markets at reasonable interest rates. Latin America's jobs outlook is also discouraging, despite government furlough schemes that are still funding temporary employment suspensions and mitigating the destruction of salaried jobs. Employment has declined by 10 to 25% in Lima, Peru. An extreme case, it fell by more than 50% in June of 2020. As of September, the region's employed population had fallen by more than 25.3 million since the start of the pandemic, with women and young people disproportionately affected. Those under the age of 24 have suffered the greatest employment losses, ranging from 5% in Mexico to 44.4% in Chile. Moreover, there will be no back to normal after the coronavirus pandemic. Digitalization will likely depress demand for contact-intensive occupations and push firms to automate and streamline their operations at the expense of jobs. Overall, Latin America's underperformance during the pandemic has revealed pervasive shortcomings in state capacity that extend far beyond the region's obviously weak healthcare systems. A few governments lack the necessary information to identify poor households and provide them with financial help. Others had it, but could only write a check instead of transferring funds electronically. The resulting queues and clusters of people outside bank branches may have contributed to the coronavirus spread. And long after schools reopened in Europe and Asia, classes in much of Latin America remained suspended, owing to persistent logistical difficulties. This is adding permanent know-how costs to the ongoing job destruction, particularly for low-income households. Another structural weakness is the region's dual labor market, which disproportionately exposes low-income workers to income shocks. About half of the region's workers are informal wage earners or self-employed without a college degree. In Nicaragua, Paraguay, and Peru, more than two-thirds of workers are informal. Unable to benefit from wage subsidies and furlough schemes, many of them depended during lockdowns on government cash transfers that compensated for the only part of their lost income. In contrast, many Latin American countries offer generous labor protections to high-wage salaried workers. Colombia, for example, introduced a subsidy equivalent to 40% of the minimum wage for all formal jobs in firms that had experienced revenue losses. Argentina's government went even further, doubling severance payments and eventually banning layoffs outright. But such protection goes to a minority of formal employees, while most informal and independent workers remain unprotected. The consequence of this were painfully obvious in the first half of 2020, with incomes of people at the top dropping by much less than those of people at the bottom. The COVID-19 crisis is an opportunity for Latin American governments to strengthen the state, reform dysfunctional labor markets, and accelerate the search for a new social contract. That means rethinking social protection, including by moving towards universal healthcare coverage, reducing barriers to formal employment, and enhancing income stability for independent workers. But the necessary changes are politically difficult to achieve. Restructuring government agencies and labor market rules quickly ruffles the feathers of powerful vested interests, which is why governments have until now remained on the path of least resistance. With several Latin American countries scheduled to hold elections in 2021, the crucial question is whether the regional political climate would improve or worsen in the pandemic's aftermath. A crisis can unite citizens, but the pandemic has also sown plenty of divisions in Latin America. Between professionals who can work from home and factory workers who cannot, between vulnerable elderly people and young people who are subject to government restrictions, and between formal workers who receive wage subsidies and the self-employed who have lost all of their income. Latin America's virus contagion curve may be flattening, but some countries' poverty and business bankruptcy curves continue to rise. If the public health shock is followed by a protracted economic crisis that leaves many people behind, trust in government and trust in institutions will suffer, and politics will become even more fractured in Latin America. COVID-19 could yet become a pandemic of instability and hopelessness.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. January the 3rd marks the first anniversary of the U.S.'s terrorist assassination of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. Now, the general was the ultimate anti-terror figure in the region, who had been successful in countering Daesh, al-Nusra Front, and other terrorists who had been brought to the region. Stay with us as we talk about the commanders of the resistance to terrorism and hegemony on this debate. As commemoration ceremonies are taking place throughout Iraq, there we have seen commemoration services taking place in Syria, in Lebanon, and now Iraqi people have gathered and have lit candles and, of course, showing their respect for those two brave commanders and others who were killed in that U.S. terrorist attack 1 year ago. A commemoration ceremony in the Iraqi capital for General Soleimani. I'd like to welcome now my guests to the program. Out of Pittsburgh, author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik, and the director of Rosales Strategic Studies Institute, Dr. Sam Matthew-Torabi, out of Qom. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start it off with Daniel. Now, Daniel, what we saw take place almost a year ago, from an international legality perspective, we would definitely say illegal, definitely against international law, and yet nothing has been done. It seems even talked about, really, that something was going to be done from the so-called international community. Your assessment of this?
Well, I think the U.S. has effectively destroyed international law, at least as it applies to the United States. It has undermined its enforcement mechanisms, for example, by sanctioning the International Criminal Court because it wants to investigate U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. has made it clear that it believes it's above the law, and the international community either can't or won't force it to abide by international law. Another example of this, of course, is that the U.S. lost an International Court of Justice case to Iran, I believe it was last 2019, over sanctions. And so the U.S.'s response was to say, well, we're not going to honor this decision. And by the way, we're withdrawing from the International Court of Justice, which is the highest court in the world. So we see time and again that the U.S. Has found a way to evade international law, and sadly, I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Okay, viewers, if you're looking at the live images there, you see, well, you were looking at those images actually from the actual site of where the assassination had taken place last year. That was live images out of Baghdad there, where people had gathered to commemorate. Sam, when we look at the situation, and we go back a year ago, with Donald Trump basically saying, yes, he ordered the assassination, do you think that there was a miscalculation there? Or why do you think that the United States ordered this assassination to begin with?
Good evening, Nigel.
Good evening.
Well, you know, we have to understand the context of the Syrian war. The Syrian war was the closest thing we've had to a world war since World War II, if you don't count the wars that existed in Africa, which some have also counted as world wars. So in this quasi-world war, you had on the one side the U.S. and its allies, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the NATO countries, Turkey, and of course the Takfiris that they used as their mercenaries and as the, you know, head of the spear, so to speak, to destroy Syria and Iraq. And on the other side, you had the people of Syria, the people of Iraq, the resistance with Iran as its leader, and of course then later Russia joining after Haj Qasem Soleimani went and personally spoke to Putin about the strategic and historic threat that this issue represents. And in this Syrian war, and in this world war, the result of this war was that the U.S. and its allies were badly defeated. And so when you have the Americans deciding that they're going to assassinate the main commander of this war, because according to everyone, Haj Qasem was the main commander of this war. He was the one that led the war, especially the ground war. So it seems that this was almost out of spite. This was out mm-hmm. of a reaction to having miserably failed in this war, in this world war, having experienced a strategic defeat exactly the way they did in Iraq prior to that, during the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And so, as far as I can tell, this was basically just trying to kill the person who had defeated them.
Well, Daniel, what about that? You heard our guest in Qom say basically it was a reaction because of a strategic defeat. With that being said, then, is it that the United States not only does not care about security in this region, and basically many would say has been behind much of the turmoil, but even in Europe, because we know these same terrorists that caused such havoc in this region also did the same in certain European cities.
Yes. Well, I think that certainly part of what the U.S. wanted to do with the murder of Soleimani was to, as my colleague said, to get retribution against a military commander that had outsmarted them in theaters like Syria. But I also think and I fear that another goal of that murder, as well as the recent murder of the nuclear scientist in Iran, is to try to provoke a war with that country. The U.S., particularly under Trump, for the last 2 years, has tried to engage in incredibly provocative actions, hoping that Iran would overreact and give some type of justification for an armed intervention. So far, Iran has shown itself to be very restrained in its responses, very smart in its responses, and has managed to avoid that. I hope it is able to do that in the next 3 weeks, because, you know, there is a lot of noise out there that Trump may be wanting to start a war before he leaves office in 3 weeks.
Okay, Sam, your take on that. Do you think that this was about basically the United States wanting, or as our guest in Pittsburgh said, that Trump wants to start a war with Iran, or is it something else?
Well, let's first see if he leaves office in 3 weeks. That's still a question, number one. So that's the first thing. The other thing is, and we talked about this with my colleague the last time we were on the debate together, which is that from the Iranian perspective, a U.S. attack is actually strategically beneficial to Iran. It allows Iran, it gives Iran the moral legitimacy and the legal right to take military action against all U.S. interests in the region, and to expel the U.S. from the region, from West Asia. So this is something that the generals in the Pentagon know. And, you know, one of the interesting things, and this is something that our viewers should know, the main group in the U.S. who is against the war with Iran is the Pentagon, because the Pentagon knows that they would lose such a war. So whether it was the Bush Jr., or whether it was now Trump, or any other president who was saber-rattling and was thinking about starting a war with Iran, it is always the Pentagon and the military leadership that prevents these U.S. presidents from actually launching a war against Iran, because a war against Iran would actually be the end of U.S. presence in West Asia. And the end of U.S. presence in West Asia basically ends U.S. global, any sort of attempt by the U.S. to maintain global hegemony. And this is something that comes out of these statements and the analysis of the Americans themselves. This is not, you know, my analysis or some sort of a claim. This mm-hmm. is something that, if you look at the literature by U.S. strategists over the last 70 years, particularly after they became the inheritors of the British in the region and in the world, they inherited the British Empire after World War II. One of the central claims and one of the central issues is having control over West Asia. So for the U.S., it always weighs between losing its position in West Asia and attacking Iran. And so far in these 40 years, it has chosen not to attack Iran mm-hmm. directly. It has always done it through proxy, whether it was with Saddam during the 8-year imposed war, or whether it's, you know, through other forces, terrorism or economic war or psychological war, whatever, all these sanctions and wars that we've experienced over the 40 years. But it knows very well, when I mean it knows, I mean the Pentagon, and I mean those who actually know war. Mm-hmm. They know that if they engage in a direct war with Iran, it would be the end of U.S. presence in West Asia, and it would be the end of U.S. hegemony in the world.
What about Daniel, when we look at this assassination and the goal behind it, many would say that probably the United States wanted to have a devastating effect on the resistance, and what experts are saying, especially in this region and beyond, is that they have not only stopped the resistance, but actually it is more fervent than ever because of that assassination. Would you say that the United States miscalculated or not by making that move, that the situation has actually gotten worse for Americans in the region?
It may have miscalculated. On the one score that, as you say, I think the resistance, particularly in Iraq, to U.S. presence is now grown. It was right after that that the Iraqi government made it very clear it wanted the U.S. to leave. And the Iraq continues to want the U.S. to leave. And I guess the other miscalculation is, again, if I'm right, that they wanted to draw Iran into a greater conflict, that they were unable to do that with the murder of Soleimani because Iran did not overreact. So in two different ways, I would say the U.S. miscalculated.
Well, Sam, how much of this, if you look at what the U.S. had claimed throughout the years, that they were actually fighting Daesh and fighting terrorism in the region, and then, of course, then they kill the ultimate anti-terror commander in the region. Do you think that actually that facade was taken away for those who still believe that the U.S. was actually fighting against Daesh, or how do you see it?
Well, actually, Trump was the one that tore down the facade. He did it during the elections 2016, where he talked about the Americans sponsoring Daesh through the Saudis and the Turks. And also, you know, the interesting thing is this, that when you have you actually have Trump, when he becomes the president, talking about, he actually said it, he said, we will let the Iranians and the Russians beat Daesh, and then we'll take on the Iranians. He literally said that. So it was clear from the beginning that the Americans in the Trump administration were waiting for Daesh to be taken care of by the Iranians and by the Syrian people and by the Iraqi people and the Russians and the resistance forces. And then after that, they were going to go after the Iranians. Now, you've mentioned a couple times the word miscalculation. Well, the entire U.S. approach to Iran over the last 40 years has been a miscalculation. It's based on false information. It's based on propaganda by Iranian exile groups who have no idea what's going on in Iran. It's based on the delusions and illusions that exist in Tel Aviv and Riyadh and Abu Dhabi about Iran. And it's basically a closed bubble in which people talk to each to themselves and suggest policies and act on policies and implement policies which have no connection to the reality of what Iran is.
Well, why is that the case? Why is that the case? Almost 42 years later, since the victory of the revolution in Iran, why are they still miscalculating when it comes to dealing with the Islamic Republic?
Well, first of all, let's not say that that's a bad thing. You know, it's a good thing that they don't understand us. And if they want to continue not to understand us, that's fine with us. The point is that they come from a background which is an imperial background. It's not the imperial background of the British, where they would directly come and take over a country, but they are the inheritors of the British Empire in this region, and they claim to be the hegemon, and they have the right to do anything they want in this region. And the most important aspect of their strategy in the region is to not allow governments that are based on the will of the people. So if you look at Saudi Arabia and all these, you know, states in the southern Persian Gulf, they are medieval, family dictatorships. If you look at Israel, it is a apartheid state in which a minority is occupying a majority. And so for the first time in the region, you have a country like Iran who has a popular revolution that establishes a republic based on a written constitution. You know, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a written constitution. Israel doesn't have a written constitution. It has the Westminster system. And so you have a state in the Islamic Republic whose leadership and whose system is based on the will of the people. So this is the root of why the Americans can never come to terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Because Iran is an independent country, and its power is based on the people.
Stay with me. Well, Daniel, what about that? Sam talked about the will of the people, and actually, after the assassination of General Soleimani, we saw millions of people taking the streets, not only in Iran, but in Iraq, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Syria, actually mourning what had happened and promising that they would seek revenge and that they would be united in their demand that the United States must leave West Asia. Your take on all of this, because it seems that by actually this terrorist attack that the United States committed, that they increased the solidarity of the people in the region and their determination to make sure that the U.S. leaves this region.
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, General Soleimani was a very popular figure, not only in Iran, but in Iraq as well, in Syria as well. It seems to me that they picked the wrong person to go after there. They delegitimized themselves. Again, they didn't get Iran to react in a way that provoked a major conflict. They clearly overshot the mark on this one. And I think the U.S. will pay for this for a long time, because I think the region will continue to reject the United States' presence there. And I think this assassination, as you say, only increases that resolve.
And Sam Mathy, your take. I mean, we saw after the assassination, we saw little kids actually in the streets here in Iran saying, "I am Qasem Soleimani." That basically young people are saying that they will continue his way. The legacy that he's left behind, and where do you see as far as the resistance going from here?
Well, let's just be clear that there's no American kid saying that, you know, "I am General Petraeus." There's no Israeli kid, you know, saying, "I am General, you know, whatever the latest murderer from Israel is." So the reality is that we have people like Haj Qasem, like Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. These are people who worked on themselves for an entire lifetime as a spiritual matter. I think the most interesting aspect of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi's life is their spiritual life. Of course, you know, this is not the place to maybe discuss it, or maybe we can talk about it at some other forum. But that's the reality we have in these people, people who are deeply spiritual people. They are not, you know, Wall Street weapons lobby generals who have to, you know, resign from the CIA because they had an affair with their mistress. These are not people who are revolving door generals who, you know, go and fight in Iraq and then become lobbyists for the weapons industry and then now are becoming defense secretary. So it's a completely different worldview and model of how a human being has to live, how a commander and a general and a soldier lives, and it is something that's completely lost in the West. They don't have it anymore. There might have been something close to that when you look at people like General Marshall, you know, who from the famous Marshall Plan, and you know, who spent almost 60 years of his life in service. And when he was asked at the end of his life, you know, "Will you write a memoir?" He said, "I don't want to profit privately from my public service." Can you imagine a U.S. general saying this today? So this is the thing. We shouldn't assume that because they both have uniforms, we're talking about the same species. These are two different species, and this is the point about General Soleimani, and this is why he was so popular, and this is why he's a hero across the world, not just in this region, but across the world.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Sorry, we're out of time. Author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh, and director of Risalat Strategic Institute, Sam Mahdi Torabi out of Qom. Appreciate both of you being with us. And as always, we appreciate you staying with us on another debate. Bye-bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. Stay tuned.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. We've been discussing about Shahid Qasem Soleimani and the international coverage surrounding this great personality. In the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's a pleasure and an honor to have you both here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. So, we started off by talking about the international coverage of Shahid Qasem Soleimani and how he's been misrepresented. I'd like to start this discussion today with reminding our listeners, inshallah, that Trump, President Trump, is the guy who's, before he was elected as president, described Obama and Clinton as the founders of ISIS. That's a quote. Now, after the assassination of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, he actually likened him to Baghdadi. And I hate the way that he says Shahid Qasem Soleimani's name. Why can't they ever pronounce anything right? He says something like Soleimani or something.
I think they do it on purpose. Because they can't be that dumb, right?
It's part of their psychological warfare to kind of not pronounce anything. It's never Muslim. It's always Muslim.
Yeah, Muslims and Iran.
So the attack of the USA on our beloved General Qasem Soleimani. Why? This is the question now. Why did they choose to do it now? Bearing in mind that Shahid Qasem Soleimani has been around for a long time. It was President Trump himself who said that we should have done this 20 years ago, right? So why now? And I'd like to ask Sayyid Mahdi to begin the discussion.
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. I think before we start talking about, exactly why this was decided to be done at this time, one of the things which involves this international media coverage is what was being said about Shahid Qasem Soleimani, right? Of course, on this side of the world, he's known as a hero of the oppressed people all across the world in multiple nations. But in the Western media, he was portrayed very negatively, to say the least, right? Some of the things that they said about him were quite painful for people to read or listen to, especially when you know that this is complete, utter, blasphemous lies
right,
about an individual who